You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, my name is Jemima and I will be your host for today. I'm covering for Bronnie, who is away being very diligent in writing her honours. I am in studio with Felix today, who is producing The Wire. How are you?
Hello, it's good to be here.
It's good to be here.
It's been a while since I've been in the studio.
Yeah. Felix is always good to go to class at midday.
So I'm on holiday.
On holiday, so here, which is lovely to have you. Efai Akine, coming up on the show today, Dear Science, with Alan Blackman. Bronnie discusses the largest source ever detected of gravitational waves, rust on the moon, and liquid that defies gravity. Of course, there's our weekly chat with New Zealand First's Tracy Martin. I speak to her about the new relationship and sexuality guidelines for schools, where New Zealand First stands on rainbow policies. Felix spoke to Unite Union about workers in managed isolation and quarantine facilities. We then have part two of a chat that Sherry Zhang had with sex educator Sarita Das about healthy, safe sex. And finally, another sequel, Bronnie brings you part two of her chat with Jess and Noor from Rainbow Elections 2020 about their LGBTQI plus policy tool for this year's election. Kaua e wareware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo e ēnei kōrero anō he pakihere rokiroki marunga I te pae tukutuku o irarangi poho me haere ki 95 BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95 BFM website. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, because we love hearing them, tukupātui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395, or wire mai rāne, you can give us a call in studio on 309 3879. We always love hearing what you've got to say. There's some interesting stuff on the show today, so flick us a text, give us a call, we'd love to talk to you. Anyway, anything else to add about the show today, Felix?
Yeah, feel free to send us a text, it gets lonely up here. love to hear from you.
Not enough, we'd love hearing what you got to say. So let's crack into it.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
I'm just going to give you a brief election coverage update. With the election having been postponed due to the second COVID-19 lockdown, we also paused our election coverage for a few weeks, but we're back and we're starting again with housing. This week, most of The Wires will be looking into housing issues that are relevant this election. The schedule for election coverage is that we will be looking at different focus policy areas for the next 6 weeks. So this week is housing, then local economy, then health in the referendums, environment, foreign affairs, and finally human issues, taking you right up to election day on 17th of October. As we have already had a week on housing, the Wednesday Wire will not be covering housing policy this week, but you can check out our podcasts on the 95BFM website under podcasts, The Wire, and then 95BFM election coverage 2020 to hear Tracy Martin speak on New Zealand First's housing policies. E tēnei wā tonu, now it is time for...
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
This week on Dear Science, Bronnie spoke with Alan Blackman about the largest source ever detected of gravitational waves, rust on the moon and liquid that defies gravity. Here is their conversation.
First of all, with these gravitational waves that were detected by LIGO and Virgo, I think it would probably be good to start by telling people what Virgo and LIGO actually are and what they measure. Because I sort of was baffled even by the title of the article. I'm like...
Well, that's a very good question. So LIGO, I don't know what it's called, but I don't know how it's pronounced, but it stands for Laser Interferometer and Gravitational Wave Observatory. And Virgo has probably got some similar acronym, which I haven't found yet. But LIGO is situated in the States, and in fact, sort of on both sides of the States, in Washington State and Louisiana. And Virgo is in Italy. And together they make up what is, as it says in the name, a gravitational wave observatory. And what they are looking for is, as the name suggests, gravitational waves. And so these come essentially from the collision or melding or bringing together of enormous objects in the universe. And when that happens, you get gigantic amounts of energy released, and some of that is manifested in these gravitational waves. And so these have made the news recently because last year, in fact, on May the 21st, these two observatories found the largest gravitational waves that have yet been detected. And that was kind of big news. Now, I don't know if you got the little pictures that I sent you of said gravitational waves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you'll agree with me that they are small.
Yeah, they don't look like much.
Yeah, it just basically looks like four squiggles, basically. So it's four little peaks. They lasted a total of 0.1 of a second. So this is a tiny, tiny, tiny effect on Earth. But from this, and they've only just published this in Nature this month, they have figured out that this gravitational wave, these gravitational waves, these biggest ones ever seen, must have come from the collision of two black holes. And somehow they managed to figure out that these black holes, and don't ask me how they do this, but they managed to figure out these black holes are about 16 billion light years away. So essentially, they came from a time when the universe was about half the age that it is now. So that's an awfully long time ago. And as I said, they figure out that this has come from the collision of these two black holes. And what has happened is these two black holes have come together, they've collided, and they've made one big black hole. And this big black hole has a size around about 142 masses of our sun, which is pretty darn large when we're sort of comparing it to Earth size anyway, because the sun is massive compared to the Earth. They reckon that when these came together, they gave out energy that is equivalent to about 8 solar masses. So this is through Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared, which tells you about the equivalence of mass and energy, which is a massive, massive amount of energy, but it's been dispersed over the entire universe essentially, and we're just getting those little squiggles as a result of that. And
so there is something significant about this size, right? It's a
yes, very, very, very much so. And this is a size that shouldn't be allowed really under the current theories. So these calculations sort of say that the black holes that led to this, or that were involved in this collision, were around about sort of 60 and 80 solar masses of our sun. And this kind of goes against the theory of black holes, because what we think about black holes is that they're formed by the collapse of stars, and it's when stars get incredibly massive and sort of collapse under their own weight into these incredibly, incredibly dense species. And so if this is correct, if their calculations are correct, then that's probably going to lead to maybe a rethink about what we know about black holes. And you know, so this is really, really big news for all the folk out there.
If I'm correct from my understanding, yeah, weren't they saying you can't possibly have a black hole that big, because if the corresponding star had been that big, then it wouldn't have formed a black hole, it would have just kind of exploded. Is that what they're saying?
Exactly. And so, you know, we think we know a lot about the universe, but we know very little, really, if we're going to be absolutely truthful. I mean, we've got all this stuff called dark matter out there. We don't know what it is. So there's still a heck of a lot to learn about the universe. This whole thing about black holes and everything, you know, these are just theories. They're pretty good theories at the moment. But, you know, it might be that now they're going to need some work on those theories. They need to look at them again, all because of these four little squiggles that lasted 0.1 of a second. Utterly amazing. And as I often say on this, more work is needed. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what comes of all of this. But this is a relatively new technique, this whole gravitational wave thing. So, you know, some very, very exciting stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Well, and then to move to the second topic is also out of this world, but not quite so distant, maybe, just over the ditch on the moon. And they found some rust on the moon. Now, I guess to begin with, what causes rust and why wouldn't you expect to find that on the moon?
Very good question. So in order to make rust, you're going to have oxygen. Okay, that's the number one thing. So what you find on, for instance, Mars is a lovely red colour, and the red colour is due to essentially rust, which is a compound of iron. It's a type of iron oxide. So this is what you get when you react metallic iron, as everybody knows, with oxygen. You leave that around for a while and it'll start rusting and you get that lovely red colour. Now, anybody who's looked at the moon lately will know that there's not a lot of red on the moon, you know, beautiful white colour or, you know, black, etc., etc. And what the Apollo astronauts found when they went to the moon was that there was a lot of absolutely pristine iron on the moon, which is, you know, quite surprising in itself, I guess. But when you consider that the moon, A, doesn't have an atmosphere, and B, therefore has no oxygen, then it's really not surprising that you're going to get this pristine metal there that hasn't been, you know, touched. So what people in Hawaii, in fact, have been interested in is, you know, what's going on the moon. And so about 10 years ago, they were looking at water on the moon. And they found that at sort of higher latitudes, there was a significant amount of water. And of course, water contains oxygen. And so therefore, they sort of started having a look at the rocks and stuff like that and seeing what the effect of water or whatever would be. And to their surprise, what they've found now is the signature for a thing called hematite, which is an oxide of iron. And again, made from the reaction of iron with oxygen. And so then the big question comes, right, how does the oxygen get there? Where does the oxygen come from? You know, space is a vacuum. There's, you know, it's, well, supposedly anyway, it's as close to a vacuum as you're going to get. There's not really a lot in space. So where does the oxygen come from? And, you know, this is something I've never thought about. And it's kind of interesting. The oxygen actually comes from the Earth. And so what happens is that when the moon and the Earth and the sun all align in that order, then we have a thing called the solar wind. Okay, the solar wind comes from the sun. And it is, you know, essentially a wind, and it blows, quote unquote. And what actually is thought to have happened, or is happening, I guess, is that you are getting oxygen blown out of the atmosphere on Earth when everything's in the right orientation, and it blows onto the moon, which is really quite amazing. But sort of obvious when you think about it. So this is their theory anyway, and what they are seeing is that the hematite, the iron oxide that they see, is only present on the side of the moon that faces the Earth. And again, if you know anything about the moon, the time it takes to go around the Earth is pretty much exactly equal to the time it takes to go around its own axis. And so therefore, always the same face of the moon is facing the Earth. So we only see one side of the moon. They see that the amount of hematite is higher on that side of the moon than it is on the other side. And again, that makes sense when you're talking about the solar wind blowing the oxygen onto the moon. So, you know, I found that kind of interesting. And again, I'm sure there'll be more work on this. And, you know, people are talking about going back to the moon one day. I presume it'll happen at some stage, but you know, there's obviously a lot more investigation that needs to be done. You know, and it's, you know, hard to believe, I guess it's nearly 50 years since somebody once, well, you know, since the last person stood on the moon. You know, it's an awfully long time, and you know, I'm sure there's a lot more science that needs to be done up there. So yeah, kind of cool.
All right, well then, to turn to our last one today, it's very bizarre, and I think this is another example of one where people need to watch the video and see it for themselves, because these scientists are floating these toy boats upside down beneath this levitating strip of water. Now, how do they do this? Sort of what forces are at play, I guess?
Well, again, the first question comes, you know, why the heck did they study this? You know, you know, there's some weird stuff that gets studied out there, but this is all to do with sort of fluid flow and things like that, and physicists are interested in that. And so a bunch of scientists in Paris, and they've just published this in Nature, so it shows you that it's, you know, important work. And What they've done is, as you say, they've made little toy boats float upside down on the bottom surface of some levitating liquid. And so the way that they do this is that they're using vibrations. So what they have got is liquid in a closed container. And they found that if they use vibrations of the right intensity and the right frequency, that they can actually get a strip of this water essentially to levitate within this closed container. So what you then have is essentially a strip of water that's got a top side and a bottom side. And obviously we all know that things float on a liquid. You put something down on top of a liquid, it's going to float, provided that its density is less than that of the liquid. But what these guys did was to actually take a little toy boat and put it on the underside of this floating strip of water, and then make it float on the underside of that floating strip of water. And again, the way that they do this is all by using vibrations. Now, the reason that they can levitate the water is that the vibrations stop these little droplets forming on the bottom of the water. Once you get droplets forming, then the whole thing collapses and it'll just fall down to the bottom under the influence of gravity, obviously. So again, using the right frequency of these vibrations, they've got this strip of water levitating. And so what they then have is essentially a piece of, let's say, compressed air beneath this water. The air pressure beneath this water has got the water pressure on top pushing down on it, and it's also got gravity pushing down on it. It's that increased air pressure is sort of pushing up against the water as well. And that's essentially, to my understanding, is what makes this boat float underneath it, okay? So it's a very subtle combination of effects, and providing you get absolutely everything right, your liquid will levitate, you've got your little boat, that'll float on the bottom surface of the water, and away you go. Now, as you quite rightly say, you really should search this out on the net and have a look at the little video on this, because you know what I'm saying really doesn't do it justice, but it is kind of cool. It looks sort of like an anti-gravity sort of thing, which is, you know, really, really nice stuff. So obviously there's got to be some sort of use for this, because otherwise why study it? So they're talking about that it might be useful when it comes to separating sort of little solids out of liquids, so plastic particles and stuff like that. Perhaps they might be able to use this sort of technique to remove plastics from the ocean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but very, very...
mess. Just a...
Yeah. But obviously they're just doing it on a small scale at the moment. But, all the physical principles and everything are obviously very much of interest in this. So... again, it'll be interesting to see where all of this goes. And that's, you can say that about all science, really. That's what happens. You make these, cool discoveries, and then, what happens to them, what comes about as a result of these discoveries, that's the really interesting stuff, in addition to, I guess, the sheer interest of all of these things that we've talked about today. So,
yeah.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. We will be right back after a little break with our regular conversation with Tracy Martin.
A lot of so-called kombucha is made from concentrate. That means it's tap water, flavour and non-nutritive sweetener, mixed up with some sour kombucha vinegar base. Doesn't exactly scream ancient health tonic, does it? Good Buzz is different. They're one of the only brands on the market to make authentically true brew kombucha that's never diluted. Just fermented, then bottled, so it's good, naturally. Reach for the real deal. Reach for a Good Buzz. Real good booch, brewed and bottled in Tauranga.
Totally non-non, heinous dude. Bill and Ted are back for another excellent adventure through time. We reckon it'd be totally triumphant if you got to go along for free. So grab your B-card, be excellent. And stay tuned to 95BFM all this week for the chance to win tickets.
Bill and Ted, what have you got to say for yourselves?
Be excellent to each other. And party on, dudes.
Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter in Bill and Ted Face the Music. In cinemas now, rated excellent and rated PG.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
this morning, I had our weekly chat with New Zealand First Minister Tracy Martin. We talked about new relationship and sexuality guidelines for schools and where New Zealand First stands on rainbow policies. Can you begin by explaining the new relationship and sexuality guidelines?
Sure. So it's a refresh of what was the sexuality guidelines from 2015. In response to not only sort of the changing environment and some other evidence we've got from the chief censor and so on about and the voice of our young people asking us for better relationship and sexuality education, but also in response to an Aero report from 2018 that said that the delivery of relationship and sexuality education through our schools was not at the standard that it needed to be for our young people to be fully informed and to be empowered, and also that it wasn't consistent, it wasn't delivered consistently across the country. So this is the second step of trying to make it more consistent and more, I suppose, appropriate for the times. The first one was actually 40 curriculum leads that I announced about 3 months ago now that will support schools in the delivery of this curriculum document.
So you say this is sort of the second stage. Are schools required to incorporate this into their health and sexual education teaching, or is it more of a suggestion and there is meant to be a third stage or a further step?
Right. So the New Zealand curriculum has several strands to it, and one of the strands is the health and physical education strand. So that's the part of the New Zealand curriculum that this fits into. So obviously, when I say physical education, when I say health, some of that is healthy eating, some of that is actually about exercise, all that other sort of stuff. But this relationship and sexuality education fits inside that part of the New Zealand curriculum. And at what this document does is it shows that what should the outcomes be? What should a six-year-old know about relationships? And that would be about making friends and keeping friends and being a good friend, right? That's an appropriate level for a six-year-old to have a conversation. And when it comes to the sexuality education part of the curriculum for a six-year-old, it's about, do you know your body parts? Do you know what they're called? That's just the appropriate level of this curriculum for a six-year-old. When you're talking about a 16-year-old, consent, for example, coercive control becomes part of what's appropriate to have a conversation about. Different gender diversity is appropriate to have a conversation about. Respect for others. What does a healthy relationship look like in the context of a negative one, e.g., you know, family violence or consent or not, lack of consent or coercive control. So you see that this document has, well, these are the outcomes. At the end of the year, this young person at this age should have these understandings and should be able to articulate this, and it is appropriate for the age at which that young person is inside their schooling.
So schools should be incorporating this into their curriculum from now on.
The outcomes are, they are required to meet the outcomes. It's the bit about how they get there that has been inconsistent, and some of the outcomes have not been met. So the schools are required to deliver the outcomes of the curriculum. They have flexibility about how they will do that, and that's why in this particular area the boards of trustees are required every 2 years to actually have a conversation with their parental community about, how do you think it would suit our community? Because a Pacifica community might have one way of delivering it, Māori another, local migrant community might have another way of delivering that message to get the same outcomes, but they must deliver the outcomes.
Let's move on to the next topic I was looking at today. So recently the University of Auckland's Rainbow Law Group created an online LGBTQI policy tool called Rainbow Election 2020. The policy tool outlines 15 policies to benefit the LGBTQI community. Currently, the Green Party has voiced support for all 15 policies, and the Labour Party has supported 11 of the 15. Does New Zealand First have any intentions to announce any rainbow-based policies?
Well, I've said that I will get back to that group once I've had an opportunity to look through what they're asking for or asking about. One of the challenges with these type of response surveys, and it's the same, strangely enough, it's the same for Family First. What they want is they want a yes, no, black and white answer to what are quite complex issues sometimes. And they know, they've written down words that say, will your party do da-da-da, and yet they know what they mean by that single sentence. I might think I know what they mean by that, but there's very little opportunity for shades of grey. So it's not something I take flippantly, so it's something that I've given a commitment that I will have a look at it, and merely I've been waiting for time to get to look at this, recognising that I'm still doing my ministerial work, still also doing, you know, New Zealand First work and trying to answer all these surveys at the same time. So I hope to have a response for them, but it will be a well thought out and well considered response. And the bit that's tricky is when you just want yes or no or support or oppose, when there are shades of grey and everything.
Do you think that political parties perhaps don't prioritise minority groups with their policies in the lead up to election?
I think it's very, if you're talking about your overall general manifesto that goes out there, it would be literally a tomb if we put every single tiny piece of work that needs to be done to enhance this group of New Zealanders' lives. So often you don't see those things inside the standard manifesto, right? Because the manifesto tends to work with the big issues. And of course, the manifesto inside health, like let's just take health for example, you've got your big chunky things, because no matter what minority group people are from, if they have a heart attack, they want to make sure they can get heart surgery, right? And we all have a heart. So therefore, there are big chunky things that we all have that we all need. But if we talk about, let's talk about the trans community, inside health, there's some really niche services that they need, that need to be addressed. There's a, you know, there's an enormous shortage of specialists, both from mental health and physical health perspective, for the trans community in this country. It's unlikely to see that in the main manifesto because it's very niche in this way.
You say that these policies or these ideas are niche and that they perhaps aren't the big picture. However, these are big issues for this community.
Absolutely.
So isn't it important to look at those as well?
Of course. But what I just said was that, you know, if you've got your overarching manifesto, and then it is for, you know, I guess what would be, as opposed to a yes, no, or support, oppose survey type of a thing, having an article where, like, this is the question, what is your answer? But you're able to give them, say, 200 words, which even that is a challenge, on what is something incredibly important to, you know, a particular group of New Zealanders' lives. But it's a great way to inform those New Zealanders of what, you might say support, but what does support actually mean in that, you know, in that answer? That's what I'm saying. There's, I would have preferred having those questions and being able to give 150 to a 200 word answer, which is literally a paragraph, to better express what actually is the view of New Zealand First around those important issues for that group of New Zealanders.
So you think that's perhaps more valuable to have a, you know, have what each party sort of a little blurb about what they think about that particular issue than a yes or no?
Yeah, I do, because what's going to happen is, you know, you've got the, let's just take where we started from. So the Green Party has agreed to all of those. Labor, I see that, so they must have come back in the last couple of days, because when I first saw this up on
quite recently,
media,
just before the weekend.
Yeah, so they've been working on it as well, right? What's going to happen is that the organisation will then say, well, back in 2020, you said you supported, but you haven't done it. Because if you had done it and supported and you had done it, we would have this by now. Now, I don't even know what the this is. In the first instance, that their expectation is, but it would be, you know, when you have an opportunity to actually put a paragraph, you have an opportunity to say, we would like to work with the community for them to design. Yeah, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So how are you going to deliver it? That's just as important as saying, yeah, we believe in it, but how are you going to deliver it?
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. I also started to speak to Tracy as the Minister of Internal Affairs about the controversy around the government using facial recognition for CCTV surveillance. However, she cited that there was confusion in the way the department is planning to use the facial recognition technology and suggested that it is perhaps being portrayed in an alarmist way by the media. Tracy told me that she wants, quote, the New Zealand public to make sure that they have clarity that the Department of Internal Affairs is not using CCTV cameras on street corners to verify anybody's identity, unquote, as that is not what has been explained to her. Tracy is planning to make an announcement on this issue on her social media pages this week about what she understands the department is using facial recognition technology for, and Bronnie will speak to her about this further next week.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.
So a few months ago, former host of The Monday Wire, Sherry Zhang, spoke to sex therapist and educator Sarita Das in part one of the interview. They spoke about queer sex, masturbation and shame, female pleasure and the inadequacy of sex education in schools. In this half, we pick up with Sherry and Sarita talking about what constitutes healthy, safe sex before delving into navigating sex as a queer person of colour and fetishization.
Healthy, safe sex, there's no, like, I can't give you like a 1, 2, 3 bullet point on what healthy, safe sex is, because that's going to look different for everyone. But I think a huge part of it is getting to know your body better so that you can communicate that to the other person about what it needs. And that looks like mindfulness stuff. It looks like learning how to breathe. It looks like learning to be okay with making sound. It looks like learning what the difference is between giving touch, receiving touch, taking touch, allowing touch. These are all different types of touch. And so, for example, say, Sherry, you and I are together, and you, like, okay, I'm going to do this thing because I think that this is for Sarita, so I'm going to do this thing for Sarita sexually. And then I think that what you're doing is for you, so I just tolerate it. Sherry's really enjoying this, so I'm going to let her do this. But Sherry thinks that she's pleasuring me, so nobody's winning. You know?
Sounds like it's happened before.
Yeah. And we do this all the time, and it's about the fear of ruining the mood by talking during sex, you know? Like, oh my God, if I say, stop, I want it slightly more to the left, or faster, or like, can you do this? That we're scared that we're either being too demanding, or like the person's going to get frustrated, or a litany of fears that we can have around that.
Yeah, actually something that I've recently noticed or have been pointed out to me is that I constantly apologize during sex. I'm always like, sorry, I'm being so demanding. I'm sorry, I'm taking so long. I'm sorry, like, which is not even just something in sex, it's something I do too much in life. I'm always apologizing. So,
And that's not your fault, because that's how you've been taught to operate in this world. As a female person with a female body, that is how you have grown up in this world. And also as a person of color, if you use those terms, and as a female person of color, that's like extra weight to apologize for everything all the time, including your body, always. And so that's really, really powerful that you're sharing that, because again, that's getting rid of that shame of being like, no, I'm not going to apologize anymore. So yeah, like someone listening to this will be like, oh shit, I apologize a lot too.
Sometimes when I am flirting with someone or things are getting a bit sexy, in the back of my mind, I have this thought of like, am I being fetishized?
Oh yeah.
And I, you know, for myself, and I don't know if maybe other listeners who identify similarly to me feel this too. And I don't know, you know, how do you work through that? Because that's something that's always kind of on the edge of my mind. Like, you know, I trust someone and it's communicative and I feel safe, but I always have that question in the back of my mind.
I 100% know what you mean. I think because of our history and because of colonization and the way that female bodies, female brown bodies, female Asian bodies have been sexualized, hypersexualized, that's always going to be you know, in our minds, you know, it's always going to be that thing of, is that what's happening right now? And I think dating white people, there are some difficulties if you think strongly about race stuff a lot, like I do. I guess an indication for me, like, I look at who else have they dated, you know? Had they dated a whole bunch of POC, you know? Like, have they been respectful of their cultures? Do they, like, tokenize or fetishize other cultures, you know? Like, it's difficult to know until you kind of get to know the person a bit better. I guess, fuck, you could even straight up ask them. Be like, so have you ever been with a woman who's not white or a girl who's not, you know, your race? Like, is that, what experience have you had with that? And, like, watch their eyes, like, go into fear mode.
I'm going to ask a kind of final question of, I would love to do a page of, like, cute, fun sex tips for the queer community. And so what would be some of those tips that you would
give? Oh, I hate sex tips.
Oh,
they're stupid.
Okay, because, tell me why.
Because it's not, there's nothing that I can tell you as a sex tip that's going to help you when you interact with somebody else sexually, because you have your body and they have their body. Say they're a new person, you don't know anything about how to pleasure them because you're not them. They have to have the agency to be able to, well, the other things that I talked about before, A, feel what your body wants, and then B, communicate it. So no sex tips I give you is going to really help, because it's within you and the other person to be able to advocate for what you need sexually right then. There's no tips, you know, like when people come to me in sessions, they're like, oh, like, give me some sex tips. I'm like, there is none. You have to have trust that when you ask for something from the other person, it's hard when you're not speaking specifics. So let's say I am on a first date and I'm into this person. They're really hot. They're into me. I'm really hot. And we're getting to the bedroom stage and you just start doing the things, right? You do the motions, you're doing the kissing, you're doing the taking the clothes off, you're getting down to like feeling like you're going to have sex. Like, check in, be like, so I'm totally cool with having sex right now. How do you feel?
Yeah.
And they could be like, yeah, cool. Be like, cool. Like, this isn't a weird question to ask, but what does sex mean for you? Like, you know, just checking the fuck in, because I know that it's fun to go in the mood in the moment, and I've done that so many times, but I've also done the sex thing so many times where we just fall into it, and then afterwards you're like, that wasn't as good as I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
But then you've really only got yourself to blame because you didn't ask for what you wanted. Mm.
That was sex therapist Sarita Das speaking to former 95 BFM producer Sherry.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern recently announced that security services and managed isolation facilities would be brought under the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, granting them a living wage. Unite Union has called for this to be extended to other workers at those facilities. The union is also calling for the removal of $1,000 fines for workers who refuse to be tested. I spoke to Unite Union's John Crocker. So could you give a quick outline of what Unite Union is calling for here?
Well, we're calling for, in a broader sense, a living wage for all essential workers. But in particular, we're saying that the government is in a position to give the living wage to workers in the managed isolation and quarantine facilities.
As it stands, how much are these workers employed by the government paid?
Well, they're paid by their employer. So some of them would be on as little as minimum wage. Some would be a bit above that. I'm talking about the hotel workers specifically, which we represent.
Right. So why do you think that this should be increased?
Well, because the nature of their job has drastically changed from a few months ago. You know, they're expected to undergo this testing now. There's much more stringent health and safety measures. And what we saw during lockdown was actually essential workers that are keeping our society together are not being paid very much. And so there's a broader call for living wage because it's ethical and these people are vital to what we're doing and protecting ourselves from this virus.
And so what is it about these fines for refusing COVID-19 tests that is unfair for workers?
Well, it's a very heavy-handed approach to a problem that's not there. We haven't had any reports from any of our workers about the refusals to take these tests, and the government is threatening to fine minimum wage workers. That's just wrong. they should be paying these people more, and there isn't a problem here that they need to fine people about. It's just wrong to fine minimum wage workers like this.
What would you propose instead?
If people aren't comfortable with these tests and working in these facilities, then the government should be moving them into other roles where they don't have to have these tests. They should redeploy them into other areas while increasing to at least the living wage the rates of everybody working in these facilities.
You also mentioned that the government is bringing security services under the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment. What do you mean when you say that this principle should be extended?
So the government is to bring in-house rather than using private. The Prime Minister announced doing this, that they will be paid a living wage. So there's a recognition from the government that the security workers should be paid a living wage who work in these facilities, and that should be extended to all workers in those facilities.
So why is it that so many workers in essential roles are paid below living wage?
Well, that's quite a big question. It's a lot of these jobs would be seen as I suppose. It's difficult to unionise some of these workers. The employers aren't very good. They don't want to pay a living wage. The sharp end of capitalism, I suppose.
So you also called for guaranteed sick leave for frontline workers. What is the current policy for sick leave, and why is that ineffective?
It's a bit ad hoc at the moment. We've got some employers who are signalling to us that they intend to do the right thing, but it's important that people stay home from work when they're symptomatic. And the current statutory sick leave allowance of only 5 days a year is not sufficient to cover that. We want people to do the right thing and stay home if they're symptomatic, probably get a test these days. And there's also a gap between when the wage, the leave support scheme kicks in and the test. So you can get tested, but you want, if you're tested 2 or 3 days, you shouldn't be attending work if you're symptomatic. But you're also, your employer can't access it. So what we're saying is in these situations, which are really critical that people aren't turning up symptomatic and that they're getting tested, the government needs to guarantee sick leave for them. Because we don't want someone in a situation where they're, you know, thinking about next week's rent or next week's food bill versus staying home unpaid because they're symptomatic. We need them to make the right decision, and we need them to be looked after and supported to do that.
All right. Well, that's all I have in terms of specific questions, but is there anything else that you want to add on the topic of essential workers?
Well, we're calling on the government to do this because the contract negotiation, the contract's extended to December, so they've got an opportunity to do this. It's very easy for them. We think the hotels that we've spoken to will be on board with this, but also that, you know, all essential workers should be on the living wage. So not just this example that I'm talking about, it should be broader than that.
Apologies for the spotty signal there. That was John Crocker from Unite Union. We'll be back after a quick break.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa.
Kia tū pato, be careful.
Well, here I go on my adventure to save the world and rescue the princess. Wish me luck.
It's dangerous to go alone. Take this.
This is just a piece of paper that says Kia tū pato.
Yeah, good advice there.
Okay.
Kia tū pato, be careful.
Māori words, karawhiua, give it a go.
Bikes and Beyond is taking the future of mobility and hitting you over the head with it. The Lavelle Smart Helmet, redefining your safety with mapping directions, podcasts, indicators, hands-free calling, radio. It'll even text your mum where you are if you bail. Comfort, convenience, safety, and it looks pretty cool too. Bikes and Beyond, your local for future mobility solutions. Specialists in e-bikes and e-transport solutions since 2012. Common Unity Builder Better World activist since birth. Stores in Newmarket, Devonport and Waiheke Island.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so last century.
95BFM's popular shows, features and interviews are available as podcasts on RSS and Apple.
You're listening to Totally Wired, the all-new music show. My name is Jess Fu.
Thanks for stopping by for the 95BFM Kids Show.
Welcome back, it's True Sky.
Greetings and welcome.
This is the Rhythm Selection.
So this is one for the musical theatre nerds.
Welcome along to Thursday Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry.
And we will let you know about Drive Island, of course.
Never miss out again. Becasts available on Apple Podcast or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire with Jemima on 95BFM. We now have part two of Bronnie's piece from last week about the Rainbow Policy Tool for the election that I also spoke about earlier in Tracy Martin's interview.
Last week I spoke to Jess and Noor from Rainbow Election 2020 about their LGBTQIA plus policy tool for this year's election. The tool was created in collaboration with 13 Rainbow organisations and aims to both inform the public in voting and policymakers in how they can protect the Rainbow community. It highlights 15 policy areas that they are asking for political parties to take a stance on, split into four categories: health, education, community, and legal. Last week we spoke about the issues of disengagement by voters and political parties. This week Jess and Noor give some examples of the types of policies that fall under those four categories. We began by talking about health.
With health in particular, some of the issues that we came across was that there aren't enough rainbow-friendly health practitioners who would understand the intricacies of even something as simple as the difference between gender and sex, as an example. And if we take this into the context of within the trans community, it might be hard to access gender-affirming healthcare because they might be seen as a burden to the health system, and it can be quite costly to go under the public health system. So that's one example of where you need some specific tailoring to the rainbow community. And then another one is if we're talking about mental health, it really makes a difference if the practitioners actually can talk to these issues and help them in the way that talks to their own experience of being a person in the rainbow community. And we think that currently within the public health system, there aren't enough practitioners who have that knowledge and that cultural competency, which is really lacking. And that's what makes it different between the rainbow populations, between the general population. And this goes without saying for other communities as well, such as, like, for example, people of color or like Maori and Pacifica communities, in which your health needs would be different because of your context. And that's very similar here, but not saying that they are one of the same.
Jess then commented on some of the policies that fall under the education umbrella.
In terms of education, we know that some schools are doing fantastic work and some schools are really lacking. I think as a rainbow young person, you want to feel safe at school. You want to feel like your communities are represented. And for lots of rainbow kids and young people, this isn't the case. So our tool, what we're advocating for, is for rainbow experiences to be talked about in the curriculum. So that covers things like health and sex education, so making sure that at school you're learning about diverse gender, diverse sexuality, diverse sexual characteristics in the health sector, but you're also learning about rainbow experiences and things like history and social studies, and even, you know, little things like a math problem, including someone who's gender diverse or someone who has a same-sex partner. Making it easier for rainbow people to feel included is not especially difficult, but just does take some little tweaking of the curriculum that's working at the moment. The other concern that we have with education is things like having access to gender-neutral toilets. So if you're a non-binary person, being able to go to the toilet at school is something that you shouldn't have to think twice about, but is really difficult for non-binary kids.
Noor gave more insight into the community category.
So within community, we have policies in relation to reducing rainbow youth homelessness, reducing family and sexual violence within rainbow communities, as well as supporting trans prisoners. So the homelessness issue is massive and it's a large systemic issue. And the solution for homelessness, for example, would be to implement a rainbow homelessness plan that would include emergency housing and upskilling service providers on how to support rainbow young people, as well as specific regional support, because right now it can be concentrated in urban areas, but it might be difficult for those living in more rural areas to be accessing these services that big cities like Auckland have a lot more support and funding for. And that's the other thing as well, is throughout this process, we have been fortunate enough to get consultation and feedback from other rainbow groups. So it's been a collective effort. And in assessing all of our policies, we've really seen that we need to have training for various practitioners in a multitude of sectors to be able to have that culturally appropriate and culturally diverse knowledge to serve these communities. And I think that's a point that we want to highlight as well.
Lastly, Jess spoke about the legal aspect.
There's a few legal issues that are particularly affecting Rainbow communities. One that stands out is the Births, Deaths, Marriages and Relationships Registration Act, which does a lot of things, but one of the things that affects Rainbow communities is that it is really difficult to change your sex marker on your birth certificate. And it's a really lengthy and can be costly process. You need to have undertaken medical steps as part of your transition, which isn't available to everyone. It just makes it really difficult to be able to change your sex on your birth certificate, which is really out of step with how New Zealand operates for things like your passport or your driver's license, where you just need a statutory declaration. So we want to try and bring the Births, Deaths and Marriages Act in the line with the process that it is for driver's license or a passport, because it shouldn't be as difficult as it is.
That was Jess and Nord from Rainbow Election 2020. Now, at the time we spoke last week, only the Green and New Conservative parties had any rainbow policies. However, since then, the Labour Party has stepped up to indicate its support for 11 of the 15 policies. You can have a read of the policies yourself on their website, rainbowelection2020.org.nz, or on social media. Their launch event is happening on the 17th of September with guest speaker MP Chloe Swarbrick, and they'll be hosting a policy workshop on the 1st of October.
That was The Wire.
That was the Wednesday Wire for another week. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us for the show today. Tracy Martin, Alan Blackman, Sarita Das, Jess and Noor, and John Crocker. Thank you very much, Felix, for being a wonderful producer and for being able to be in studio with me.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Always nice to have somebody to chat to. We will catch you next week. Bronnie will be away again next week, so it'll be me and Felix back, you know, looking after it for her and having Felix in studio as well, which is always really lovely. Up next is the 1-4 with Bridge.
That was a 95 BFM podcast. Support 95 BFM with a B card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.